You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 183 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Human Evolution, A Spiritual Scientific Quest, 9 Lectures, translated by Simon Blaxland DeLange. This is Lecture 5, given in Dornach on the 25th of August, 1918. Yesterday I gave you a diagrammatic indication of threefold man. It is indeed the case that in the cultural life of modern times there is very little feeling for an understanding of man's being as it needs to be grasped from a spiritual scientific standpoint. Nevertheless, we must make every effort to gain a clearer understanding of this being of man. For it is only out of such an understanding of the threefold nature of man's being that any ideas of real significance that we may acquire concerning not only the whole of human life, but also man's development between death and a new birth, can be sustained. Today we shall consider this threefold being of man in greater detail. As we already indicated yesterday, the first object of our attention is the human head. In a certain sense, this human head is really an independent form in its own right. You can position yourself in front of a human skeleton and see how easily the head can be detached, in that you can lift it off like a ball. In actual fact, the division between the three members of human nature is not so simple that one could say that what can be so readily removed from the skeleton, like a ball, is the head part. These elements are not so strictly segregated as this. We need gradually to extricate ourselves from a purely diagrammatic understanding, and also from what nature herself suggests to us, to a living feeling. As you saw yesterday, I had to draw not three circles next to one another, but one circle for the head, a second circle that overlapped the head, and a third circle that overlapped both the other two. So if one were to represent threefold man diagrammatically, in accordance with his physical sense, one would have to draw him thus. The head region, see red circle A in the diagram, the trunk region, oval, yellow, and then the limb region, orange. Actually, three spheres, even if these spheres are drawn out lengthwise. With the head region, hence with what is shown here as the red circle A, is connected the spiritual aspect, which is, as you saw yesterday, the youthful structure, parenthesis small, lightly hatched circle, white slash yellow, close bracket. This spiritual aspect of the head is a youthful spiritual structure, whereas the head itself is an old physical structure, an essence with a physical form. Thus, what is applied to man in general is totally appropriate for the head. Even though it is not correct in this generalized form, it is correct for the head. The white, in parentheses, spiritual form that I have drawn here, with respect to the head, represents the time when you are asleep, out of the head. When you are awake, it is united with the head and is, for the most part, inside the physical head. So it can very easily be separated from the physical head. It goes out of it and comes back in again. This is certainly not the case for the middle or chest region of man's being. Everything enclosed by the thorax, by the ribs and backbone, is connected with the spiritual world. But this spiritual dimension is less markedly outside this region when you are asleep, and remains closely connected with the physical body. As for the third region, that of the limbs, which also includes the sexual organs, there is barely any real separation between the sleeping and waking conditions. One certainly cannot say that the soul and spiritual aspects are disconnected in sleep, for they remain united to a greater or lesser degree. One could, therefore, draw a person in a waking state by means of another diagram, and say that if this is his physical aspect in a waking condition, bracket C diagram 2A, dark hatching or red, close bracket, this, in brackets lightly hatched or white form, would be its spiritual counterpart. And this would be someone who is asleep, in brackets C diagram 2B, red and white. The spiritual aspect is therefore united to a greater or lesser degree with the body, and only this particular part is really outside it, see diagram 2B. From a certain standpoint, these would be appropriate drawings for showing the contrast between the states of waking and sleeping. Now, you will only understand the important things that we have been speaking about if you relate this way of distinguishing the three aspects of man's being to another one, which is linked with what I was explaining here last week. If we reflect further over these three regions of the head, the trunk, and the limbs, we can say that man's essential being is characterized solely by the trunk. It was, therefore, the living breath that was breathed into him by the Elohim. Breathing is his distinctive quality. The division here is not so simple as in the skeleton. The breathing process through nose and mouth forms part of this middle region of man's being. The differentiation is therefore not so easily represented diagrammatically as one would like to be able to draw it. But these are the sort of difficulties to be expected in understanding a matter of this kind. Thus, earthly man, in his essential being, is characterized by the trunk, while the head region, as a physical form, does not really have this distinctively human quality. One cannot say that the human head is quintessentially human, and indeed it has something thoroughly Ahrimanic about it. It is actually organized in the way it is because certain of its formative principles are a residue from old sun, and have therefore been left over from this second evolutionary stage of the earth. Our head, in all its complexity of form, would not be as it is if it had not acquired its initial form in these ancient times of old sun. Hence these are old, primeval, formative principles extending today into the earthly sphere, which for this reason must be described as Ahrimanic. Residues of old principles always have to be regarded as luciferic or Ahrimanic, according to their particular aspect. On the other hand, what makes man a citizen of the earth, where the principles of earthly evolution are mainly at work, is that aspect of his being associated with the chest or trunk. The limbs are also not wholly of a human nature, but have a strongly luciferic quality, and their formative principles are not as yet complete in their development, but will only have evolved to their full extent when the earth has arrived at its Venus stage. Thus, when the preceding Jupiter stage has made the transition to the age of Venus. It will be then that the formative principles which today, I would say, still manifest only a shadow of the essential nature of this third aspect of man's being, that which relates to the extremities, will be active in their true form. Thus here, man is anticipating what will only be a reality in the Venus Age, and manifests it in our time in an incomplete germinal form, which does not extend beyond something of a rudimentary nature. This is how things appear from a cosmic standpoint. Thus, from a cosmic point of view, our human form is such that as regards the forces involved, in our head we are repeating the period of old sun, whereas in our chest region we carry earthly evolution. And, insofar as we live in the extremities, we bear within us the seeds of Venus evolution. This is how it appears from a cosmic viewpoint. From a human point of view, it looks somewhat different. Here we must consider the human individuality as it progresses from one incarnation to another. In this context, we must say that what we bear in this incarnation as our head has a relationship to our previous incarnation. What we now bear within us in the region of our chest is related purely to our present incarnation. And what we bear within our extremities already has a relationship to our next incarnation. I told you last week that the head has something very revealing about it, especially if viewed as a negative image. Footnote in the sense of the negative of a photographic image. Translator's note, end of footnote. If you were to take an impression of the physiognomy of the head and look at this physiognomy, you would recognize in this negative physiognomy of your head much of what you initiated in a former incarnation. It is the opposite situation with the extremities. You cannot, in this case, take an impression, but you have to adopt a different course. You need to think away the head and the trunk, and instead consider everything that your hands and legs do, and of this you form for yourself a picture. You have to make a sort of map of this activity. You see, every time you do anything with your hands, something happens elsewhere. You engage in activities and come in contact with other beings. If you were to paint all that your hands and legs do, if you were to draw a picture of what your hands and feet, arms and legs enact in the course of your life, and it would be a very lively picture, you would discover a complicated map in this drawing. And from it you would find revealed what lies in store for you karmically in your next incarnation. From this map, you would be able to discern much of the karma of your next incarnation. This is of profound significance. Just as the impression of the physiognomy in a state of rest, in the firm outlines of a drawing of it, reveals what happened in the previous incarnation, what one might be able to record of the way that arms, hands, legs, and feet behave would be extraordinarily instructive with regard to what a person will do in his next incarnation, what he will carry out, where he will go, where his legs will take him. If you were to retrace all the steps that your legs have taken, a whole map would emerge from this. You would obtain some remarkable patterns. One's inclinations are not without influence on these patterns. Much of one's secret inclinations come to expression in them. These traces that remain are very revealing of what the next incarnation will bring to a person. So, this is how to view it from a human perspective. Before this, we were considering these phenomena from a cosmic viewpoint. This way of understanding the different aspects of man's being, which is engendered from a present perspective, also implies a connection with the secrets of the ancient mysteries. Where there was a more atavistic knowledge of these matters, but where such secrets as have just been touched upon were already known. There is a beautiful legend relating to King Solomon about the certainty with which a person makes his way to the place where he is to meet his death. The meaning of this legend is that there is a particular place on the earth where a person is to die, and he directs his footsteps to this place. Parenthesis, you will find a lecture where I spoke about this particular legend concerning Solomon. Close parenthesis. This is concerned with the ancient mystery knowledge of these things. Now, when someone is living in the ordinary way, he only has his everyday consciousness. But man is, as you see, a highly complicated being. When he is awake, when his youngest spiritual member, the head, is within his physical head, he knows nothing of this head. You will rightly say, "Thank God that we know nothing about the head, for if we know about the head, this merely gives us a headache." People are only conscious of their heads when they have a headache, but then they know that they have a head. Otherwise, they are unconscious of this, and to a remarkable degree, far more so than in the case of any other part of the human physical body. A person may be very glad if, in normal consciousness, he knows nothing of his head. But beneath this consciousness of the head, which normally has cognizance only of the outer world, which sets out to know only what is in its vicinity, lies another kind of consciousness, a dream consciousness or knowledge. Your head is continually dreaming. While you are aware of the outer world in the way that you are well familiar with, you are actually perpetually dreaming beneath the threshold of consciousness, in the region of the subconscious. And what you are dreaming in this head of yours, if you were able fully to grasp it and bring it into your conscious awareness, would give you a picture, and an accurate, comprehensive picture, of your previous incarnation. For in your head you are subconsciously dreaming of your previous incarnation. This is indeed so. There is always a slight awareness of this, a dreamy awareness of one's former incarnation, which is overpowered by the stronger light of everyday consciousness.
By the year 747, before the mystery of Golgotha, this outer consciousness had become so strong that the subconscious awareness of one's previous incarnation had gradually been completely extinguished. Before that year, however, much was known about this dream consciousness of the head. This is why you find that at the foundations of ancient cultures, repeated earthly lives were everywhere adduced as a fact. This is simply because this subconsciousness of the head had not yet at that time receded so completely into the background, as happened throughout the fourth, but is now proceeding apace during the fifth post-Atlantean epoch. It is also the case that very little is known in ordinary consciousness about the soul and spiritual associations of the thorax and the trunk, or man's middle region. It has in itself something of a dream quality. Only on occasion, and then very chaotically and irregularly, does this thorax consciousness thrust its way into a person's dream consciousness. If someone is able to breathe regularly, if his heartbeat is even, and if all the functions of his middle region are in order, the consciousness of this aspect of his being is not as clear as that of the head. For even in ordinary life, it has a dreamlike quality. As I have explained here in the past year, we dream in our feelings of this middle region of our human nature. But when what lives in the feelings, and can be experienced only in this realm, is elevated through a consciousness that becomes increasingly clairvoyant, when, in other words, a person learns consciously to survey what is going on in his thorax in the way that he is otherwise only able to survey what lives in his head consciousness while he is awake, this thorax consciousness, that consciousness that lives in the trunk of the middle region of man's being, splits into two distinct parts. One part dreams back into the whole time between the previous death and the present birth or conception. Thus, whereas in very deep dreams in your head consciousness you have a subconscious experience of your previous incarnation, in the dreams of the thorax you have an experience of what has in the meantime elapsed since that previous incarnation and your present birth. And in the dreams that belong more to the lower part of the thorax, you have a powerful awareness of what lies between your impending death and the next earthly life. Thus the consciousness that is concentrated in the thorax, of which people today are largely unaware, is in reality a dream consciousness, both of the time before this birth and of the time after this death. Thus, the solution to the riddle of what lies between our last earthly death and our next earthly incarnation, with the exception of, or even including, what we are now experiencing between birth and death, may be found in the subconscious life of the middle region of man's being. And in a realm of experience which remains in a deep state of unconsciousness throughout one's life, and which can be brought to light only if a person is able to call it forth through constant work with spiritual scientific studies and exercises, so that certain moments of sleep life, which would otherwise pass unconsciously in a state of sleep, are drawn to the surface, and the person concerned becomes conscious during sleep. The tableau of the next earthly incarnation can be summoned forth from the third region of human nature, from the subconscious realm of the limbs or extremities. The ordinary waking consciousness that people have today is really a kind of subordinate impulse which streams into the head from without. However, behind this consciousness, there lies another which extends over the previous incarnation, over the life from that incarnation to the next, present one, and then again over the next incarnation. But people sleep through any awareness of this. In the head, there lives the consciousness of the previous incarnation. In all the organs that preeminently serve the function of out-breathing, there works a strong consciousness of the life between the previous incarnation and this one. In all the functions that contribute to in-breathing, there is a consciousness that extends from the present incarnation to the next earthly incarnation. And in the limbs, in all the mysterious processes of this system of the body, there exists a deeply unconscious awareness of the next incarnation. These states of consciousness have become more or less veiled since the beginning of the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, since 747, before the mystery of Golgotha. The challenge of our time is to summon forth the specific awareness of these various processes of cosmic and human evolution from the general chaos of human consciousness today. What I have just been explaining needs to be complemented by another insight into the being of man. It is indeed necessary that we involve ourselves in the discussion of these difficult matters, otherwise we will be unable to arrive at a clear understanding. I would be pleased if these difficult themes were not merely greeted with a certain passive acceptance, but if, specifically for these matters which are hard to understand, and are yet so important for people today, a little enthusiasm, a little lively interest were aroused, which is a very tall order indeed in any society today. Now, consider. You direct your senses toward the outer world. By means of your senses, you find the outer world spread out as a perceptible phenomenon. I will make a diagrammatic representation of what lies outspread around us as a sense-perceptible impression. Let this, see diagram 3 in blue, be what is out there around us. When you direct your eyes, your ears, your sense of smell, or whatever sense you choose, toward the outer world, the inner aspect of this outer world turns toward you, towards your senses. This, then, is the inner aspect of the outer world, in brackets left. Suppose you turn your senses toward what I have drawn, see diagram arrows. These senses are directed toward the outer world, and you see here what is inwardly oriented. Now follows the difficult notion that I need to explain. Everything that you behold there is manifesting itself to you from within. You may suppose that it must also have an outward aspect. I should like to give you some sort of a picture of this by saying that when you look outward in this way, you see the firmament, the vault of heaven, as the limit of your perception. It is something like this, except that I have drawn it on a miniature scale. But now imagine that you could fly out there, fly through all this and look from the other side, look at your sense impressions from the other side. Thus you could look in this sort of way, see diagram, upper arrows. Of course you do not see this, but if you could look in this way, it would be this other aspect. You would have to go outside yourself and look at the whole of your sense-perceptible world from the other side. So you would see what presents itself to you as color from the far side, what presents itself to you as sound from the far side, and so on. Similarly, you would behold what comes toward you as smell from yonder side. You would sniff it with your nose from this yonder side. Just imagine contemplating the world from the other side. Imagine sense-perceptible objects spread out like a carpet, and that the carpet is now seen from the other side. You see only a little bit, a very, very little bit of this yonder side. It is possible for me to depict this little bit only in this way. Imagine now that what I am drawing in red is what you would see from the other side, so that I can say that the world of sense perceptions can be portrayed diagrammatically as follows. To one's ordinary perception, it appears blue. Viewed from the other side, it appears red. Though, of course, one does not see this. In what you would see as red is, in the first instance, hidden everything that can be experienced between death and a new birth. And secondly, all that is described in Title and Outline of Occult Science, Reader's Aside, also known as An Outline of Esoteric Science, End of Reader's Aside, as the evolutions of old Saturn, old Sun, old Moon, Earth, and so forth. It is a kind of storehouse of what is concealed from sense-perceptible vision. There it is on the other side of the sphere, but you see only a little bit of it. I can best indicate this by saying, take this little section of the red and let it cross over, see diagram above, and intersect with the blue, so that the blue, instead of being as now in front, is behind. I would have to draw this four-dimensionally if I were to draw it in accordance with reality. So I can only depict it in a very schematic way. Thus here, left, the senses are directed toward the blue, whereas there, they are directed toward not the blue, but the red, which you do not otherwise see. But what is normally seen has crossed over behind the red and is now beneath it, and you see this little bit that crosses the other continually with your ordinary consciousness. These are your stored-up memories. Everything that arises as memory arises not in accordance with the laws of this world of outer perception, but in accordance with the laws corresponding to this world that lies behind that other world. This inner realm that equates with your memories actually corresponds to what is on the other side. When you look into yourself and delve into your memories, you are indeed seeing one portion of the world from the other side. This other side projects inward a little, and then you see the world from the other side. And if you were now able to slip through your memories, as they have been inscribed in this way, parenthesis, I spoke about this a week ago, close parenthesis, if you were able to go down there and look beneath your memories and see them from the other side, from over there, see diagram 2, lecture 2, left side, you would see the memories as your aura. You would then see man as a being with a soul spiritual aura, as you otherwise behold the outer world of sense perceptions. But as I indicated here last week, this would not be particularly pleasant, because when viewed from this other side, man is not yet beautiful to look at. So this is an interesting adjunct to our other knowledge of threefold man. The intersection here lies in the middle region of man's being, that of the chest. You remember the drawing that I made a week ago, where I had the coiled-up lemniscates with their inverted loops. I would have to draw these here. I would need to draw this middle region of man's being with these inverted lemniscates. See diagram 3 above left. This would coincide with the sphere of memory. So, in this middle region, this threefold being of man has this capacity to turn inside out, where inner becomes outer and the outer becomes inner, where what you would otherwise behold as a cosmic tableau, as the great cosmic memory, you now see as your own little microcosmic memory. You see in your ordinary consciousness what has occurred from your third year onward until now. This is an inner record, a small part of what is of a similar nature to it, and which constitutes a record of the whole of world evolution, and which lies on the other side. It was not without reason that, as most of you will be well aware, I once spoke with you about the fact that man actually has 12 senses. And I also mentioned this in the notes at the end of my last book titled The Riddles of the Soul. We should think of these senses in such a way that several of them are directed toward the sense perceptible, while others have an opposite orientation. These are directed toward what is already inverted. See diagram 3 at the bottom. Those directed toward what is outwardly sense perceptible are the senses of ego, thought, language, speech or the word, hearing, sight, taste and smell. The other senses, on the other hand, do not engage with man by way of his consciousness, because their orientation is toward his inner being and toward the opposite aspect of the world. These are the senses of warmth, life, balance, movement, and touch. Hence, we can say that for the ordinary consciousness, seven senses lie in the light, upper part of diagram 4, and five senses in the dark, lower part. And the five senses lying in the dark are turned toward the other side of the world, and also toward the other side within man. See diagram 3. Hence, there is a complete parallel between the senses and between something else of which we shall speak in a moment. See diagram 4, circle. So if we accept that we need to list as senses those of hearing, language, thought, ego, warmth, life, balance, movement, touch, smell, taste, and sight. We have essentially those senses ranging in the diagram from the sense of ego to the sense of smell, which lie in the light, in what is accessible to ordinary consciousness. See the hatched area of diagram 4. And everything that is turned away from ordinary consciousness, as night is turned away from day, belongs to the other senses. The boundary between the two is only approximate. There is some overlapping. Reality is not always so accommodating. But this way of ordering man's being according to the senses is such that you need merely to draw in place of the names of the senses the signs of the zodiac: ram, bull, twins, crab, lion, virgin, scales. 7 signs for the light side, and 5 for the dark side: scorpion, archer, goat, waterman, fishes. Day, night, night, day. And you have a complete parallel between microcosmic man with, on the one hand, what is oriented toward his senses, and on the other, what is turned away from them, but is oriented toward his lower senses, and what in the outer cosmos signifies the alternation from day to night. What takes place within man is the same as what is enacted in the whole structure of the cosmos. In the cosmos, day alternates with night. And within man, there is also an alternation between day and night, namely waking and sleeping, even though both may have separated themselves from one another for the present cycle of human consciousness. During the day, man is oriented toward the day senses. We can just as well equate this with the ram, bull, twins, crab, lion, virgin, and scales, as with the senses of ego, thought, language, and so on. You can see the ego of every other person. You can understand the thoughts of another person. You can hear, see, taste, smell. These are the day senses. In the night, man is oriented toward the other senses, in the same way that the earth is turned toward the other side, only these are not yet fully developed. Only after the Venus age will they be so fully developed that they are able to perceive what is on the other side. They are shrouded in night, just as the earth is in the shadow of night as it passes through the other regions of the heavens. Through the other signs of the zodiac, man's journey through his senses is a parallel course to that of the sun around the earth, parenthesis, or of the earth around the sun. It makes no difference which we choose in this case, close parenthesis. These phenomena are indeed connected, and those who bore the wisdom of the ancient mysteries were well familiar with these connections. This gradually vanished from consciousness in the 4th post-Atlantean epoch, but it must be revived once again. Despite the resistance that rises up amidst modern culture, it needs to be reinstated there. For in the depths that one acquires there, it becomes very possible to understand what is happening now in the outward tapestry of social life. So long as you separate the life of nature and the life of the spirit or the inner world, in the way that present-day humanity loves to do, you do not arrive at concepts that could play a part in historical evolution, but you are instead overwhelmed by the concepts that predominate in the outward affairs of humanity today. Overwhelmed. There are many examples of this. It is indeed the case that in the course of, say, the last couple of centuries, people have done an incredible amount of thinking. It would be possible to gather up what people have been thinking for the last 200 years, what ideals they have formulated, ideals which they have regarded, and continue to regard, as being great, ranging from the ideal of the age of the Enlightenment to that of the great would-be Caesar, Woodrow Wilson. Everything that has been said about the various ideals has come out of the thoughts that people have been having over the centuries, specifically these last two centuries. This has been forming people's thoughts. World history is, however, affected only to a small degree by these thoughts. It is stirred by something altogether different, by those thoughts that have been working and weaving in actual realities. And never have the thoughts that buzz around in people's heads been further removed from the great cosmic thoughts that live in actual realities than in our time. What has been inspiring human beings for, say, the last 150 years, in order to fashion the world in a certain way, have not been the ideals of freedom, equality, brotherliness, justice, and so forth, but thoughts that are interwoven with, for example, the advent of the power loom. That the power loom became part of modern developments in the second half of the 18th century, that this significant invention of the power loom entered into human evolution in place of the traditional method of weaving by hand, and the whole mechanistic culture of modern times arose from this power loom, are symptoms of the objective thoughts, the real thoughts, that have given the world the form that it still has today, and out of which the catastrophic chaos of the present has emerged. If one is seeking to write a history for the catastrophic chaos of the present, one should not turn to the thoughts that have been buzzing around in people's heads, but to these objective thoughts of the founding, the inventing of the power loom, and on to the growth of big industry and its shadow, socialism. For although big industry and socialism appear to be opposites, they are polar opposites that belong together and should not be separated. These objective thoughts need to form the basis of our consultations and our observations of historical development. One then finds that in the course of the 18th and 19th centuries, and especially in that part of the 20th century in which we are now living, people entertained a number of illusions. However, although they had these illusions in their thoughts, they were overwhelmed by the objective, cosmic thoughts underlying history. These thoughts are weaving in actual realities. The only people who have really been developing a gradual interest in these objectively weaving thoughts, albeit a terribly one-sided one, are those who have formed socialism as a worldview. That is something hugely characteristic. If you follow the course of the 19th century, the bourgeoisie has increasingly been losing interest in great questions of worldviews. Such questions are indeed becoming highly distasteful to the bourgeoisie. Where possible, they shift them to the realm of aesthetics. The average member of the bourgeoisie, or middle class, is happy to hear all sorts of views in the theater as to whether spiritual beings exist or not, when there is no need to believe in them, and when it does not matter whether something is true or not. And so Bjørnson and people like him are allowed to get away with saying all manner of things. Thus, in recent times, matters relating to worldviews have, as far as the bourgeoisie is concerned, been dispatched to the realm of aesthetics, to the frivolity of what purports to be art. Where people have in the last few years really been breaking their and others' heads open with respect to questions of worldviews is in the name of socialism. Parenthesis, I am not advocating this as an ideal in the physical sense, but in an inner spiritual sense. It is in a certain sense a worthy aim, as you know. I have given very emphatic hints to the effect that I would welcome a lively mood even where anthroposophical truths are being discussed. Close parenthesis. Other people, on the other hand, have taken no notice of this. They have, I would say, disregarded those people who have actually been looking at the world from a very narrow point of view, who have been seeing the world only from the standpoint of the factory, from the inside of factories, from the inside of a printing works, and so forth. Of course, it is highly interesting to observe what kind of a so-called worldview has emerged from the standpoint of the factory, for that is what socialism is. It derives from the inside of the factory, from people who have no knowledge of anything except the inside of a factory. And the bourgeoisie, with all its abstract ideas, though abstract ideas tinged with aestheticism, so that one does not need to try so hard breaking one's head open, has little interest in what is being developed in this context. Curiously, therefore, the bourgeoisie finds itself in the middle between the totally moribund old worldview, which has lost every trace of the spiritual aspect, and would like to assign all questions of significance to the realm of aesthetics, and what has newly emerged in the form of socialism, which has no concepts whatsoever, and founds systems on mere words, on the grounds that it is unable to see the world, but can see only the factory, and moreover, the most external aspect of its mechanical side. Just imagine what it actually means if man inwardly knows nothing about the mineral, plant, and animal kingdoms, and knows only about the way in which a certain cock in a machine is moving mechanically up and down, this or that is filed and planed, and so on. Socialism is a worldview based on the perception of a world which is purely mechanical. For the socialist, that part of the world which is mechanical has been cut out, and he forms his concepts in accordance with this part which has been thus extracted. This has been allowed to arise through the principle having been adopted that one should concern oneself with things only through the medium of aesthetics. When the Theosophical Society was first established, its basic principle was seen as being the love of all people for one another. What a lot has been proclaimed about this! I have myself had plenty to say on this theme. It is as easy to do this as it is fruitless. But this is also because people like, wherever possible, to shift something that has real content into a realm where there is no actual substance. So there could also be no genuine interest in the true course of events. Certain individuals, however, have been struck by the peculiar nature of what we may refer to as the conventional way of studying history. Let us take an example. Take any account of the time of the Roman Caesars, and try to learn about this period from textbooks or in the books that the great authoritative historians have written. I believe that you will hear very little indeed from these sources about a certain personality who played an important political part under Nero. (For even under Nero it was possible to have political aspirations. And then aroused quite special attention and wielded considerable influence on Roman politics under Vespasian and Titus, so that one can say that this personality was the soul of the governments of Vespasian and Titus. Then this personality reverted to the other side under the reign of Domitian, whom he regarded as damaging to Rome. Accordingly, a lawsuit was brought against him, a lawsuit that made a great stir in Rome, and unfolded in a very interesting way. For Domitian suddenly changed from a tyrant to someone who was at his wit's end in the case, and was therefore unable to pass judgment on the man. And then when Nerva succeeded Domitian, we see this personality again actively associated with the emperor, the Caesar. So we see this personality exerting considerable political influence out of the worldview of that time. And at the same time we see him making a last attempt within the context of the Roman Empire to implant truly far-reaching concepts
brought down from the cosmos into political events. What is curious is that one does not find a proper description of this personality in any ordinary history book, not even in Suetonius or Tacitus, but only in Philostratus, and even Philostratus describes him in such a way that one does not know whether he is writing a novel or describing an historical figure. He gives an account of the life of Apollonius of Tyana, for it is Apollonius of Tyana of whom I have been speaking to you, as having had so great an influence on politics, from Nero to Nerva, and especially under Vespasian and Titus, and he is described by Philostratus. Bauer, the theologian and historian from Tübingen, was utterly astonished that one finds absolutely nothing about a figure such as Apollonius, who should rightly play a leading part in any historical account. Of course, Bauer did not have any insight into why this is so. For the point here is that we have, in Apollonius, an historical figure who indeed had this great influence, but who brought the principles out of which he worked down from the cosmic expanses. This was highly embarrassing for the Christianity that was emerging at the time of the Roman Empire. And now, I beg you to consider that everything that is inscribed in history is there by the grace of the Church. Nothing is there except what man has been allowed to have by the grace of the Church. Not without reason did an old and by no means stupid man assert that there never was a Plato or a Sophocles, but that monks in the 14th and 15th centuries had written the plays of Sophocles, for there is no absolute proof that Sophocles ever lived. Even though the assertion is untenable, and is, of course, nonsense, we have nevertheless often emphasized how uncertain the accepted version of history is. And we should be quite clear about it. We must indeed bring the present into connection with the past, for we are now approaching a great and highly significant question. We have now, from a modern standpoint, once again referred to the threefold being of man, to his connection with cosmic truths, and to the need for these truths to be once more unveiled. And what has the principal activity of the Church been, especially since the 8th Ecumenical Council in Constantinople that took place in 869? It has been to obliterate and eradicate from human consciousness any understanding that likewise Christianity had in those ancient times of man's connection with the cosmos and with the wider spiritual world. Everything betraying any hint of this connection has been eliminated with a real sense of alarm. And only because not everything can be eradicated, on the grounds that karma counteracts such a tendency, have such works as those of Philostratus survived. You can therefore understand that if you now bring the past into connection with the present, certain people belonging to the Church will become terribly worried if efforts are made, in the present, to form a link between what makes man a cosmic being and this earthly human being himself, together with his task. It is not acceptable that what should be the will of the anthroposophical movement is pursued in no more than a dulled state of consciousness, for it is necessary that it is taken up in a fully vital and vigorous way. I have now given an indication of what we will explore further. Tomorrow I shall give here the lecture in which I shall take the thread of these observations forward. The end of Lecture 5.